Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen, and I'm here with our Chief Investment Officer, Robert Sears, as well as the occasional special guest from the wider investment team to answer the big questions family investors are facing today. For those who don't know us already, CapGen is a private investment office for families with capital. We are go-anywhere investors. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover any question across any asset class in any region of the world, from bricks and mortar to portfolio derivatives. In summary, this is a podcast where we answer the questions playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. Do subscribe if that sounds up your street, and you'll enjoy two episodes a month of Talking Capital. So I wanted to mark the news that Daniel Kahneman had recently died, the renowned psychologist who, with his work on behavior and its impact on finance, behavioral finance, and the impact of the human side of our personality on the way in which we take decisions, has done so much to help us understand ourselves as investors and also how markets operate. But anyway, moving on, Robert, much more prosaically, today is the last trading day of Q1 2024. And we all know, and we've talked here about the pitfalls of imposing calendar frameworks on markets. But nevertheless, it is a thing. So, Robert, end of Q1, what have been the major themes?
Well, I think overall, Q1 has been a period of the market positivity. So I think we see that in terms of equity markets having gone up for the quarter. But not just equities. I think more interestingly, if you look at the commodity market, if you look at the broad S&P, Goldman, the old GSCI index, at the moment is actually up slightly more than equities for the first quarter. So actually for the last quarter, the commodity index, as measured by the old GSCI index, is up slightly more than equities. Now, that's a bit different to last quarter. So in a way, what does that signify? It signifies actually Q1 was about continued strong growth in the US and the market coming to price actually almost universally now this soft or no landing. And I think that's somewhat we'll come to later maybe is a bit of the danger is it's universally pricing in this no landing. Now, the probability of a soft landing may be higher, but even a soft landing is slowing growth and a chance of recession. But the market's almost pricing in this no recession period completely. But that was really the story of the quarter, is positivity on growth, commodity markets starting to do better. Now, I should say, actually, the BCOM index, which gives you broader-based commodities, is not up anywhere near as much. So again, Q1 was about oil prices to a great degree rallying, albeit still within its range, but certainly going the upward direction. So it does point more towards late cycle growth. And that was linked also to the story on inflation. So again, the market came into the year expecting the disinflationary trend to happen, and we're going to see inflation get back to 2%. And really, it's that last mile is looking a bit stickier for inflation. So inflation numbers are flatlining or going up in the US around the 3% level, so not making its way down to 2%. So again, that was somewhat of the difference. So from the start of the year, the expectation was, given inflation was no longer a problem, we're going to see this dramatic 7 or more cuts in the year. That's repriced back to around 3%. And I think that's a bit of the tug of war at the moment, is if growth is better, then even 3 cuts may not happen. So I think June remains a live meeting now for the Federal Reserve and the market expectations. But in terms of that story and where we are, I think that's going to be the key part, is actually if it becomes universally accepted soft no landing, actually the risks of the recession remain as high as they were, even if now, even the last bears are throwing in the towel at this point and expecting the market to keep rallying, the risk of a recession remains. And we've seen that although the data has remained good, there are signs even in the employment data in the US, as we've talked about on the last podcast, actually different surveys tell different information. And it does seem from a low base, actually, unemployment is starting to rise. So I think the chance of recession in the US still remains elevated. But although now, having had the first quarter, I think market expectation and sort of ebullience and risk-taking fervor is starting to take hold again. And we've seen that in some of the more speculative action in some of the stocks in the last week or so.
And I suppose the argument of the bulls, I guess, is that, of course, that's one of these feedback loops, that actually the ebullience that's felt in equity markets, I mean, I note your point, Robert, about different markets pointing different directions, but the ebullience in equity markets and the sort of positive sentiment that gives people sort of feeds through into the real economy and makes and allows the economic expansion to extend. And your point there is, okay, if that does happen, which it may well, and that may be well what we're witnessing at the moment, the challenge then is how do you, it makes getting inflation along that last mile from 3 to 2 that much harder, doesn't it? That's the challenge.
Exactly. And that's the feedback. So it makes it harder. It's going to be harder to justify cutting rates, or, and if you do, then you really do set off the inflation problem at that point in time. So that's why it is this interplay between the two. The stronger markets are between now and June, the more likely it is that we don't see a rate cut, and that in itself becomes a bit of the problem. So I think that is the interplay. But I would say, although on the whole, we have seen this improvement, and one of the areas we did highlight was the manufacturing cycle is certainly ticking up. So manufacturing was in the doldrums the last few years, again, affected by COVID, and that's been a positive sign. And that's also one of the reasons we're seeing better pricing in commodity markets as we see that manufacturing cycle turn. So there has been some good data, but at the heart of it, we are seeing unemployment start to tick up in the US. Again, when we look across different states, quite a large percentage of the states are seeing the unemployment rate rising. So we're not seeing, and if we look at credit card data again, it looks like the consumer is a bit more stretched. So the evidence and the credit card data, if not other loans, is certainly pointing in that direction. Now, I suppose the counter to that was, why were the consumers so strong in the US in the last few years? Is there's still lots of liquidity in the market. And so that's where the risk sentiment does tie in. Actually, the market itself and the level of money supply and liquidity there is, there's ample room for to extend a bull market in that situation. So that is one of the sentiment factors where liquidity can actually be fueled by that positive sentiment.
One of the arguments you hear is, well, all of that's true, but of course what changes this is it's an election year, and if you're Janet Yellen, particularly if it's even more important in election year because your choice or voters' choice in November is going to be between Biden and Trump, and it's therefore a more divided election than, you know, arguably it's been in the past, so you feel more strongly, so the argument runs, I'm not suggesting this is what's happening, that Janet Yellen's going to do everything in her power to sort of maintain this wall of liquidity, and therefore we need to factor that in, that actually this, all the things we've talked about are true, but what makes this difference is an election year.
Yeah, I think I'm not so sure there are many levers that can be pulled now at this point in the election year. There's quite a lot of gridlock, really. And I think with the point it also, when we look at the deficit, and this is a major factor, again, why are we in this position of having had stronger growth? The deficit's above 6% at this stage where unemployment is so low. This is really unusual. And the problem being, if you do enter into recession, typically that deficit goes up by more than 5 percentage points. So you'd be into a double-digit territory. So the deficit spending the last few years has helped to fuel that position. Now, I think ultimately we are in a different policy regime. So this is a moment where fiscal policy has taken over dominance from monetary policy. And certainly COVID acted as that final catalyst to that point. And it looks like whichever of those two politicians win the US election, I think next year, actually, we probably will see even more spending. So that is the bullish case looking into next year, maybe less so this year, but I think we will unleash more fiscal spending next year. So there's probably going to be a little bit of a tightening this year alongside the monetary tightening. So that will act a little bit against growth. Whether it's enough to tip into recession or not is the debatable question. But for next year, if we do go into recession or if growth slows, the chance of either of those two politicians really fueling some large spending, I think is quite likely. Now, short term, positive for growth. Longer term, it just adds to those inflationary forces. So I think that's somewhat of the factors against it. But in terms of growth, why could we see more positive growth, less so than about the election year, is there's chance for productivity gains from AI. Again, probably that's going to come later rather than earlier. There's the chance for the wealth effect to gather. So again, to your point earlier, if the markets keep going up, how can that feed into growth? Actually, consumers feeling more wealthy because their balance sheets looks a lot better as markets rise, that can feed into more spending. So that's another factor which could boost growth in the shorter term. So there are factors other than the election, but I think the election itself is probably going to be messy enough that it actually will disrupt some of that spending maybe this year. So you're not likely to see big capital expenditure from a lot of companies if there is uncertainty about the regime, because that, although we've said probably either way there's going to be more fiscal spending, I think the composition of that spending and which sectors win and lose is going to be very different depending on which party actually gets into power. So at the margins, maybe the consumer can keep spending this year and until we see unemployment go up, which is why the unemployment data is really the one to watch like a hawk. But I think the capital spending, you're less likely to see such a big surge on that this year.
So we talked about Donald Trump as election candidate, but he is also entrepreneur. We've seen in the last few days the launch of Truth Social as a public company with to pretty positive market response. That's being the foundations of that are being questioned, but nevertheless, the market has seemed to have liked it. And we've also had the IPO recently of Reddit. So, question, Robert. So IPOs sometimes reckoned to be a sort of sign of the health of the market, this idea that equity markets are really there to provide capital to new and growing businesses through IPO. I mean, clearly the markets do a lot of other things, but that's reckoned to be one of their social purposes that have gone quiet, certainly in the aftermath of sort of interest rate rises and what happened in 2022 and the suffering experienced by some of the tech businesses that have simply not come back since then. But do these IPOs tell us that that bit of the market's back in business and we can expect more offerings coming in the rest of the year?
Well, I think from the short-term point of view, it is good news for sentiment to have the IPO market opening up again. So I think that's a tick in that category. I think the Truth Social example is one of the examples which takes us back to a few years ago, does look a bit more bubbly at that point in time when you have these sort of meme stocks really just changing the ticker to change it, make it more appealing to retail stock buyers, and suddenly, I suppose it is due to supporters. It becomes a political issue of just pumping the stock up, because when you actually look at the fundamental data, I think there was a big difference between Reddit and Truth Social in actual underlying users. The price of Truth Social doesn't really make sense absent the whole sort of political and name-driven speculation, really. And I think that's an element where you do get a bit worried. When you see activity like that, that's the time to be a little bit more cautious and prudent with the way you approach the market. So it doesn't mean the market can't go up short term, but it is a sign of a bit of frothiness and a bit of a bubbly condition. And I think another example of that is just to say, when we look at volatility in markets, so that's it comes out from the pricing of options, really. There's been a lot of people willing to speculate and buy call options, but puts, nobody wants to buy at this moment in time. And implied volatility on the S&P is as low as it's really been since there's been this proper market, really, since the mid-90s. So it's been a really low level, which is a sign of market complacency. So it's a sign that there's liquidity, and it's a sign that people are getting a bit complacent. So yes, the IPO market, good if it does help some capital allocation and help some of the businesses that need capital and function better, and it also provides more liquidity exits to people, which can then be recycled. So it's a good sign of a functioning market to have an IPO market working. But I think some of the examples, as we've highlighted, I think you do get a little bit cautious at that moment in time. So definitely risk sentiment is in the air. But it is a time to be a little bit more cautious, because there is a difference between some of those large mega Mag 7 stocks doing really well, even though they've got elevated profit margins and they're potential competitive threats. There are real profits underneath those businesses. So they may be expensive, but they're real profits. When you watch out is when there are businesses which don't really have solid fundamentals, but they're still caught up in that fervor. So that's a moment of the sort of tipping point of when to get a little bit more nervous.
Let's just pick up that point about options and what's happening with volatility at the moment, the sort of, I guess, skew it's in place, which means that it's that call options are expensive and relatively that put options are less so. Does that create opportunity to do things in portfolios?
Well, I think for people that aren't protected, it is a good time to add protection. So this is when you want to buy insurance is when it's cheap, when everybody is complacent, not after the bad event happens and the cost of the insurance goes through the roof. So certainly we do maintain hedges within our portfolio because it is an offensive tool as well. It protects you against the rising risks while enabling you to stay exposed to the upside, because that is the danger of sort of the economy is always strongest before the recession, just before the recession. That's when you see the fervor get to its highest moment. That's when it's hardest to pull back. So you, in the Chuck Prince analogy from Citi in 2007, you want to keep dancing while the market's going and not have that fear of missing out. But one way you can mitigate it is having a prudent amount of insurance. And that really is an opportunity the market's presented at this point in time, is you can insure your portfolios to enable you to still invest in ideas that you think are going to do well for the long term.
Yeah, I think the analogy was extended, wasn't it? That you want to keep dancing, but you want to make sure that you're really, really close to the fire escape.
Yeah, and then that's the whole, when the fire actually happens, the problem is the escape is so small and everybody's trying to get out of the same door at the same time. I mean, that and that's a bit of why you want an option. So the beauty of the option is it is your own back door out. You get protected. You don't have to rely on selling when everybody wants to sell. You're protected and you can stay calm and sort of take your emergency exit that is just earmarked for you only, and you're not all trying to sell the same stocks at the same moment.
Let's just quickly come back to performance in the quarter that's soon to elapse. So, you know, markets have been pretty strong. Economic news has, you know, in the round been, I think, pretty positive, slightly better than, as we talked about last time, than we might have expected. So I guess we're baking in the fact that Q1 earnings, when they emerge, are going to be pretty solid. And I guess at the same time, therefore, that, you know, represents a bit of a risk, because, you know, here we are, expectations of Q1 is going to be pretty positive. In the event that they're, you know, they don't deliver, that will be, you know, a worrying sign. But sitting where we are at the moment, expectations, Robert, pretty strong Q1 earnings?
I think yes and no, because I think the economy isn't as strong as people think, and it's not universal across the board. And even as we saw before, a lot of the earnings in some of those sectors that are related to AI and the massive capital expenditure that's happening in data centers and chips, if you're in those sectors, earnings will be really strong. I think across the board, though, it is definitely more mixed, and it isn't as strong as would be apparent. And equally, when we look at the economic data, yes, it's starting to improve in certain areas, but actually growth in Europe's been pretty lackluster. So there's a chance for it to bounce slightly. So we do expect, you know, relatively positive earnings. But again, it's against expectations, and the expectation game always is sort of decline the expectations before, so that you can beat where you've been. So yes, there are pockets in the US where earnings will be very strong. but rest of the world and some other sectors, earnings may bounce, but they're still at a relatively modest level. And we shouldn't hide the fact that, yes, growth is stronger than expected in the US, but it is slowing. So it's slowing, and it's slowing the rest of the world. So the idea of no landing is still an idea of actually growth being pretty low. And I think interestingly, now growth, as we're saying, the range of expectations is pretty narrow around a positive but slowing level of growth. It could easily tip into recession given certain circumstances, but equally, it could turn out that Q2 onwards, growth is a lot stronger than people expect. So I think if some of those facts we talked about earlier all turn out in the same direction, actually growth could be a lot better than people expect. So I don't think we'll see the positive growth in earnings for this last quarter particularly, but for the rest of the year, if we do have a cut in rates at the same time manufacturing's turning up, and we see some positive fiscal stimulus in China, there is the possibility for a really positive burst of growth, inflationary growth, potentially later in the year. So I think more likely the positive earnings surprises will come a bit later if it's more broad-based. But this quarter, it's still going to be some of those sectors that are doing well and others sort of doing moderately well.
Let's turn from public markets to private markets. And in fact, I just come from a call with a client where we were talking about the drawdown and distribution profile of a mature portfolio of private equity funds. And in his observation, drawing on very wide-ranging experience, both in Europe and indeed in the US, particularly US endowments, was that there'd been quite a marked pivot from a mature portfolio of private equity funds being net cash out to being net cash in. That is to say, the underlying GPs were finding it easier to deploy capital than they were finding it easy to sell assets in their portfolios. What's been our experience with that, Rob? Where do you feel that our, when you think about it in the context of a mature portfolio, what's been our experience in that area?
Well, if I was talking about the market as a whole before sort of going to our position, I think last year, although it was a buoyant year for public markets, actually it's a relatively disappointing year for private markets, because private markets always act with a bit of a lag. So whereas marks weren't marked down at the end of 2022, unlike public markets, the valuation multiples kept pretty consistent. Last year will turn out to be a positive but slightly disappointing year, because you couldn't have the mark up because the multiples were never marked down. So that was one aspect to it. I think the second part was actually activity, as you were mentioning. And really last year was a seizing up almost akin to other bear markets we've seen in the past, like an 08 or 2000, in that deal value fell by about 40%, about 37% down. We had exit values down more than 40%. The number of funds closed was down, again, that similar amount. Fundraising was quite bifurcated. So some large funds and successful funds were able to raise, but a lot of funds weren't able to raise money last year. So we had this generally sort of stalling private equity market. And that was really the key driver for why suddenly distributions have come down quite a bit, because the good businesses were sold and they remained the ones that did exit. And the transactions that did happen were for higher quality businesses. So that was a bit why, when you look at the multiples, they still remain pretty high on transaction activity. But a large piece of the portfolio didn't get transacted. And equally, there's a lot of that dry powder left over now, which is becoming quite aged. So some of it's sort of 3 years plus of age of capital that hasn't been deployed. So I think there's a bit of a tension, a problem now is, yes, there's this big distribution problem. And famously, I think in some of these LPs had come through with a T-shirt marked on, we want DPI now. Everything's about how much you're going to distribute. So it's become the real talk of investors at the moment. but a lot hinges on that economy now. So yes, it's the sort of reacting to higher interest rates. Now, it's a bit of a different playbook to the last two recessions, because there you had a similar stalling, but then you had the big policy stimulus and activity went up. So in a way, private markets could manage it quite smoothly. Now, if we're in that environment where we're saying growth is better, the problem is you still got higher interest rates and they're not going to come down. And so then, again, the focus is very different from being helped from you getting lots of transactions away because interest rates are quite low and multiples are low. Now, arguably, multiples won't be as low as you want to transact and interest rates are higher. So it puts a bigger burden on operational improvement. So I think it is a bit of a tug of war at the moment, and it depends how quickly we see economic growth turn out. Now, at the moment, there are some green shoots that potentially we're going to see a bit more deal activity if we do have this buoyant risk appetite we've talked about, and then we can see some capital deployed and we can see more exits happening. But again, I think because you've had this stall for a while, it puts a lot of onus on making sure the businesses that are ready to be deployed, the private equity firms really have to make sure they can signal all the operational improvement they've done to get the businesses in a shape ready to be sold. So I think there's quite a lot of work for GPs to do this year to really get the exits away. But a lot depends on, if we see interest rate cuts, that could be a good news. But also if we see a more positive and higher growth environment, that's the environment which potentially can unlock this sort of stalemate we've had for a period of time.
Yes, and I think one of the observations I would make from sort of my experience of watching this asset class for a long time is one of the things that the private equity GPs are very good at is spotting windows of liquidity. And I think that's, you know, as you say, Robert, the job of a GP is to manage their portfolios, to grow those portfolio companies that are still in the phase where there's a lot of value that can be added by the private equity manager. But for those where their growth strategy has sort of largely played out, they should be preparing those for sale. And as I say, I do think, you know, the GPs are pretty good at this. When there's a window of opportunity, I think they're pretty good at seizing it, which is perhaps one of the benefits that private equity brings you as an investor. But what's our message therefore to clients about how they should be thinking about this asset class and how they should be deploying capital? I mean, are we saying stick at it or pause, or what's our philosophy?
Yeah, so I think the number one thing to say really is the argument for private equity most strongly rests on the dispersion between the winners and losers. So I think there really is a premium on being in quality names, not just being an aggregate private equity exposure. And this environment, actually, where people are pulling back and LPs now are really doubling down on their existing portfolio and not really looking at new funds, there are two big opportunities. I think opportunity number one is, on what you should be doing, is maintain that bar at a very high level. So keep your quality bar and keep being very selective about the type of manager that you're looking at. And that means that can be some hard decisions about underwriting and look at existing portfolio and new managers, but you really do need to keep your bar high. And you can afford to, because in this environment, actually, there's more scope. It's still very hard and you have to build long-term relationships, but of getting access to managers that were previously closed and increasing your allocations for the what managers you have conviction in. So I think that's really important. It isn't an asset class you want to surge in and out of. You want to maintain a steady pace of allocations, but now is a good environment actually to sort of increase your quality level within your portfolio. So I think that's a key aspect. And I think focusing on, are these managers, are they able to deliver from operation improvement? You're not going to get the same support from valuation multiples increasings. So you really do need to focus on operation improvement, differentiated strategies with sector experience and expertise who are able to really drive growth and performance within their portfolios. So I think that, again, if focusing on those aspects of the manager, differentiated strategies, with sector expertise and high quality managers that you either have long-term relationships with or that you can build conviction around from having followed them for a large number of years. So I think that's what we're trying to do with portfolios. I think in terms of that managing cash flows, I think that's the beauty of having a multi-asset portfolio alongside is you can manage and these periods where maybe distributions slow down. That's not been our experience overall completely in the last year because of the makeup of the portfolio. And actually, I think one thing I would say is the exits that have happened, and there haven't been as many, the good news is they're happening at much higher levels than where the assets are actually marked. Again, to that point, maybe because they're focusing on the quality assets. But I think that's another reason you don't necessarily want to be selling into the secondary market. Discounts are still a bit too wide for that point. So it is an opportunity about keeping the managers that you like and selectively adding new managers that where you can get access at this moment in time. And if you need to manage liquidity and cash flow, you can do it using your overall multi-asset portfolio, using the liquid parts of the portfolio.
Robert, thank you very much indeed. Time is up. Thank you very much for joining us. And I hope you join us in a couple of weeks' time.
You can subscribe to Talking Capital on all major platforms. Capital Generation Partners, LLP, is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority and is registered as an investment advisor by the US Securities and Exchange Commission. This podcast and opinions expressed do not constitute investment advice and do not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to purchase any security or any other investment or product. Nothing said during this podcast should be construed as an invitation or inducement to engage in investment activity. All information and opinions expressed herein are current as of publication and are subject to change without notice. The information contained in this podcast does not constitute research or recommendation from Capital Generation Partners to the listener. Capital Generation Partners makes no representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or of any of the information contained in this podcast. And any liability, therefore, including in respect to direct or indirect loss, is expressly disclaimed. Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. This podcast may not be copied, reproduced, further distributed to any other person, or published in whole or in part for any purpose. Further information, including our privacy statement, can be found on our website at www.capitalgenerationpartners.com.